This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is The Money. Today we're going to talk about corporate fraud. It costs the economy... Well, actually, it's difficult to say what it costs the economy. No two estimates agree on the total, but it's in the billions of dollars. Some put it in the tens of billions. If you tot up a figure for the whole world, as British accountancy firm Crowe has, we get into the trillions. Their estimate is £3 trillion, or about $5.3 trillion a year. And remarkably, it might be worth it. That's one of the contentions of a fascinating book, Lying for Money, which not only underlines how fraudsters target the weak points in the economy, and goes on to tell you how, it argues that fraud is part of the cost of economic success. The author is British economist Dan Davis.
Fraud is a really weird crime. It's actually quite interesting from an economics point of view, because it's not like any other crime. When a house is burgled, you know exactly what the crime was, and your problem is to find out how did it. But in most cases of corporate crime, it's exactly the other way around. Once you've realised that something's happened, it's usually pretty obvious who did it. But the tricky thing is working out that a crime has actually happened at all.
You really make that point in the book that fraudsters, unlike other criminals, have to cover up the crime itself. And that is made easier sometimes, I think, because their victims, the people they rip off, can go into a kind of denial.
It's more kind of a blind spot than denial, because kind of denial implies that you're perceiving something but actually trying to avoid thinking about it. Whereas really what happens in most crimes of fraud is that people take advantage of the fact that you just can't check up on everything. And in many ways, in a developed economy, you shouldn't be checking up on everything, because if you do, then you're wasting huge amounts of time and effort in the checking process itself. And also the biggest cost, and the biggest cost of the crime of fraud in general, is all of the honest business that doesn't get done because people are trying to protect themselves from what they perceive as an elevated risk of fraud. So what you have to have, if you're going to run a modern industrial economy, is a basic background of trust and reasonable expectation. And so lots of people go through their business life absolutely on autopilot, much more so than a truck driver on a long, boring straight road. And that's how fraudsters get in. They take advantage of the fact that most of the time, people aren't looking to protect themselves against being ripped off. This feels like it's an awful thing that we should do more about, and we should do more checking up and get rid of fraudsters. But it's how the economy has to work. In a lot of cases, the optimal level of fraud is not zero. And at some points when I'm feeling particularly contrary, I will often argue that the optimal level of fraud is really quite high.
I'll come back to that. But what you've said already gets us into this fantastic example called the Canada Paradox. And it really illustrates what you've just been saying.
Yeah, I mean, Canada, you know, and obviously all respect to you guys, Australia has plenty of mining stock promoters as well. But I think everyone would agree that the Canadians are basically the All Blacks of mining fraud. And Canada is the perfect place for someone who's going to carry out a securities industry fraud, because it's a high trust economy. If you were to go to kind of canonically Lebanon and start trying to carry out an investment fraud, you would get absolutely nowhere, because as soon as you unrolled your first presentation, everyone would be checking you out. Everyone would be asking who you've got family connections with going back to the 4th or 5th century. And everyone would immediately realize that you were a crook, because in a low-trust economy like somewhere like Lebanon or Nigeria or Greece, people do business with family members and with people they know. In Canada, people generally assume that everyone's honest, because they generally are, and particularly one of the consequences of that is that if you show up with a nice suit and you're polite and you remember to say please and thank you, in Canada, everyone will assume that you're telling the truth. And successive rounds of mining stock frauds haven't shaken this faith in the on the part of the Canadians. Things actually got so bad on the Vancouver Stock Exchange that they had to close the whole stock exchange down. But they still go for them. And, you know, as we both know, Canada's done very well out of that.
And your point really is, it's better to be Canada than Lebanon.
Absolutely. It's an equilibrium, and you can be in a good equilibrium or a bad equilibrium. And the bad equilibrium is where everyone's checking up on each other every time and there's no fraud. But the good equilibrium is where everyone is generally honest. You have a certain level of fraud, but it's a level of fraud that takes place because there's a general climate of trust. And one of the things, you know, over the last, 10 years, really, since the 2008 crisis, that I think everyone should be worried about is not so much that we had all of the frauds of the financial crisis era, as that the general environment of trust has been heavily damaged by those frauds. To an extent in Australia, finding that out now with the Royal Banking Commission, that even when it's not obvious that there's criminality in the sense of something that's prosecutable by law, you can get into a situation where people start trusting each other less. And that's, in my view, very dangerous. That's something that can end up just moving you into the status of a low-trust economy, and low-trust economies are not good places to live.
There's more or less four types of fraud, and I guess I hadn't thought about it and didn't realise. Just walk us through them.
It's basically an ascending scale of how abstract you want to get. The simplest possible kind of fraud is what I call a long firm, because it seems to be the oldest way that it was done, but it's just really stealing by lying. You either borrow some money without the intention of paying it back, or you obtain valuable goods on credit and then run away or declare bankruptcy when the time comes to pay for them. As an economy gets more sophisticated, people start bringing into place checking mechanisms and certification systems. And where you have a certification system, you then develop the crime of falsifying a certificate or falsifying a result saying that something is of value. And that's the crime of counterfeiting. And so that's, you know, not just counterfeiting currency. You can counterfeit safety certificates or counterfeit evidence that there's gold in a mine, for that matter. Mm. When you get to a level of sophistication in an economy where it can support wide division of ownership and a real separation of the ownership of something from the people who control it, there's a whole new category of frauds that become possible. They were first identified in the context of the savings and loan scandal in the USA in the 1980s. But a control fraud is really interesting and insidious, because what you have is, if you have an entity which you control, which pays out a proportion of its value to you legitimately in the form of salaries, bonuses, dividends, or even kind of transactions buying real estate from think parties connected to you, then you can conduct a fraud and strip mine someone else's investment without making any payments which are not taken individually as legitimate. And that's really hard to detect. It's certainly almost impossible to detect while it's going on, and quite hard to prove dishonesty after it's collapsed. And that's really the sort of thing that happened a lot in the financial crisis, because it's the thing that just destroys confidence in the overall system, because it's an abuse of the overall capitalist system. And that brings us on to the highest level of abstraction, what I call in the book the market crimes. And these are things like anti-competitive practices, insider dealing on stock exchanges, breaches of environmental safety regulations, where the thing itself is not obvious that it's a crime. We started with the long firm, and thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness are right there in the Ten Commandments. But there's no commandment of thou shalt not trade in possession of material inside information. There's no kind of ancient law of thou shalt not form a price-fixing cartel. these are things where economic markets and economic things have got so important to everyday life that we've decided as a society that we're going to raise some of their internal rules of practice to the status of crimes. And that's where things like money laundering come in, which is, you know, one of the most serious crimes that there is. But it's actually something that's been made a crime because the banking system is so useful that it becomes a high priority for the government to deprive criminals and terrorists of the ability to use it.
This is The Money. I'm Richard Ady. My guest is Dan Davis, economist and author of Lying for Money, How Legendary Frauds Reveal the Workings of Our World. All right, let's walk through them. You've got some great examples of the long firm. Just tell me quickly about the Salad Oil King.
Tino De Angelis, the Salad Oil King. Fantastic fraud, because it's just based on a simple principle of physics, which is oil floats on water, and therefore, if you are claiming to have a huge inventory of high-quality soybean oil, then you can take your banker out to your soybean oil tanks to confirm that you've got all this money that you're putting up as collateral for your business loans, and he can't tell the difference between a tank full of soybean oil and a tank that is basically full of seawater with a few gallons of soybean oil floating on top of it. In today's money, that actually lost someone $1 billion worth of bad loans when it turned out that the collateral was worthless. It would have been more of a scandal, except it happened on the same weekend that President Kennedy was shot.
This was Amex, wasn't it? When Amex had this aggressive culture of desperately trying to make money and perhaps not looking as hard as they should at things.
Yeah, absolute classic way that banks get into trouble. Brand new business line. Because Amex hadn't really been that big in secured lending to businesses before. Aggressive targets, and at that time, Amex had a simple principle for divisional management. You had to make $500,000 profit, back in the days when $500,000 was a lot of money, and no one wanted to hear any excuses about it. You know, when you set people those kinds of targets, they will try to achieve them. And the way that they try to achieve them is often by lowering their standards.
The other thing that this illustrates so beautifully is a kind of thing that carries throughout frauds, which is that once you start, it's sort of hard to stop. There's a snowball effect because you've got to keep finding something to cover up what you've already done.
Yeah, absolutely. As soon as you, if you like, open up two sets of books, they're going to diverge. So there's going to be a wedge between the accounts that you show over the world and the real accounts. But that wedge is going to grow. Firstly, because in general, successful businesses grow. And if your business is a fraud, then you're going to have to make it look like it's a success. And second, obviously, because there's compound interest on the cash that you're drawing out from the fraud. You get really crazy situations like Bernard Madoff in the USA. It's very difficult to see how he could have taken out more than maybe $50 million personally from his fraud. But in order to do that, he had to commit tens of billions worth of falsified accounts. The actual ratio of hot air and feathers to actual cash extracted in some of these things is absolutely extraordinary. And it's all there because fake numbers are really cheap to produce.
All right, let's talk about counterfeits, and there is a fantastic story of the Portuguese banknote affair.
I almost admire this guy because he was called Arturo Alves dos Reis, and while in prison for an unrelated fraud, this is another big theme that in very few of these cases was it a first offence, he decided he was going to read the statutes of the Bank of Portugal, and he discovered that Portuguese banknotes were printed in the UK at that time, and that the Bank of Portugal at the time was in the habit of authorising off-the-books issues of banknotes to fund things that the government wanted to pay for but didn't want to levy taxes for. And so in company with three or four of his mates, he forged a letter from the governor of the Bank of Portugal, tracing his signature from one of the banknotes, and showed up in the UK with a letter authorising them to print off at the time something like 1% of Portuguese GDP worth of brand new banknotes, which he then took back to Portugal and spent. And of course, these were perfect counterfeits because they were produced on the exact same presses and the exact same paper and ink as the real thing. The only reason that he eventually got caught out is that in an inspection of one of the banks, it turned out that he hadn't been able to crack the code for the serial numbers on his fake notes. And so someone had stacked one of his fakes next to a real Portuguese banknote, which had the same serial number.
What are the chances of that?
It could have been the perfect crime, because at the time, the reason people inspected his bank was that he was launching a takeover bid for the Central Bank of Portugal, which at that time was a private company that you could launch a takeover bid for. And if he'd just done that, he would have closed the loop, because he would have been able to tell the inspectors not to do that, and he would have got away with it. And that was a fraud that had macroeconomic consequences. He puts 1% of the GDP into circulation in fraudulent notes. It destroyed confidence in the currency. The consequent recession led to a coup, and that was why Portugal was a dictatorship between the 1930s and the 1970s.
The thing that comes out of that story, one of the things, is that Portuguese notaries at the time would sign and stamp anything. And that kind of goes to a wider point. If you're going to cook your books, or if you're going to fake something with certification, you need to have an offsider or a compadre or someone you can intimidate who has either professional knowledge or skills or memberships that will help you.
Yeah, the saying among sort of law enforcement in the fraud profession is that if you've got a crooked accountant who can keep his mouth shut and is prepared to go to jail, and you're not making money, then you're not trying. The thing about certification systems is that they're there to protect the honest economy from dishonest people, but they're also in many ways a benefit to dishonest people, because where you've got a system where things are notarized or audited or checked by lawyers or, you know, by geologists if it's a mining fraud, you only have to fool one person once, because once you have got your official letter notarized, or once you've got your accounts audited, then no one else is going to check up on you after that, because, you know, why would you? You know, why would someone go around re-auditing someone else's accounts? Why would you go around kind of checking up the background of a notarized certificate? Which means that we create single points of failure here. And one of the things that you can see from all of the accounting scandals is that as a single point of failure, the audit profession has proved to be really vulnerable, and vulnerable in the exact same way over and over again. And that exact same way is that not so much that there are crooked auditors, but the fact is that if a guy hasn't got a backbone, then he might as well be crooked, because someone else will be crooked and the auditor will not stand up to them.
All right, let's talk about the control frauds. Now, this is a leap in sophistication, isn't it? And the one we could look at is Nick Leeson and the collapse of Barings Bank.
Yeah, Leeson is another example of how ludicrously inefficient fraud is, because he was never in line for a bonus of more than about £1 million. That would have been fantastic for him. In order to ensure his £1 million bonus, he created tens of millions sterling of fake profits by building up hundreds of millions sterling of unsustainable debts and positions, and basically knocked over his entire bank because he couldn't admit to a mistake. But what you had there was someone who was in control of the entire Singapore office of Barings Bank. He was able to make investments and make trades on their behalf, and he was responsible for settling the paperwork on those trades. So the loop was entirely closed. He could choose what information went out of that black box, and he could expand the size of it in the knowledge that some rough percentage of the size of that entity would end up getting paid out to him. And, you know, once you've got the fraudster in control of the information loop, there's almost no limit to how big that thing can grow. the problem is inside the building rather than outside.
So Barings, the bank that went under, which had been around for hundreds of years, went under because they put one man in charge of both the trading and the back office reconciliation and made him GM of this new small office, which was desperate to expand and was going to do all sorts of aggressive deals to try and do it. And they really should have known better.
And they should have taken more of an interest. The top management of this company had the view of, we want you to deliver a profit target and we don't really want to hear any of the details about how you do it. If there had been someone at head office who was willing to say, actually, a small regional Asian brokerage like this should not be requiring hundreds of millions US dollars funding every night, then the whole thing would have been rolled up a lot earlier and it would still have been painful for them, but there would probably still be a Barings banker alive today.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. I'm talking to Dan Davis, author of a remarkable book on fraud, Lying for Money. We're just about to finish with Nick Leeson, and then we'll talk about these market crimes. But Dan, the thing I was struck by, and I didn't know this, was that this started because one of his traders made a mistake, made a loss, I think it was about 22,000. And to hide it, he created this 88888 account. Yeah. And told his bosses it was a client account. So it started with him kind of not wanting to admit that someone had made a mistake.
Yeah, there's two really terrifying things that you find out when you start looking into how these things happen. One of them is that the reason why people generally don't carry out frauds is that it's a very psychologically difficult to start thinking of yourself as someone who is basically a liar. Once that barrier is broke, though, it seems that it's broken. And once someone's committed a fraud for $22,000 to cover up an honest mistake, then almost all of their psychological resistance to keeping on going back to the well is gone. And so one of the big lessons here is that once someone's done a little fraud, you should treat them as if they've got an infectious disease when it comes to being put in positions of trust.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is that Leeson was a classic profile of the rogue trader. He was an outsider, not from the right school, very driven, very personally hungry for money. But that's also the profile of the successful good traders. You can't tell them apart just based on objective characteristics.
All right, now market crimes. Now, these are the hardest to get your head around. And you make the point, we have decided that these things are crimes. They are defined.
In many ways, the best way to think about something of the sort of thing that I call a market crime is a phrase that's used a lot in the context of banking these days, which is a reasonable expectation. It's not so much that someone is literally using a fraudulent instrument or literally telling a lie in order to steal, as with a more kind of obvious, easy to cover fraud. It's just that in a functioning industrial economy, everyone has an expectation of how everyone else is going to behave and a background sense of fairness. Some of the time, like, you know, if you're buying livestock or if you're buying a horse at an auction, the principle is very much buyer beware, and there's no expectation that someone's going to tell you about the defects or someone's going to tell you that a horse is lame. They're going to assume that you should know. Most of the time, particularly when people are dealing with financial products, there's an expectation that everyone knows that one party is at an information disadvantage, and everyone expects that the other party is not going to take advantage of the person who's misinformed beyond what you'd call a reasonable amount. And reasonable people can disagree about what is reasonable. That's why lawyers make so much money. But when something gets big and ubiquitous, that standard of fair dealing tends to get written either into the criminal code or into a set of regulations, which if you're working in a regulated industry, matter as much to you as it would if it was actually in the criminal code. And so you get things like mis-selling scandals, insider dealing, cartels, stuff that reasonable people can think isn't so bad, but actually the whole economy depends on people not acting selfishly in that way.
Now, given that the optimal amount of fraud is not zero, what can we do? How can we go through life and not get stung?
You go through life and you do get stung. There's not really all that much in the world that you can do about it. While writing the book, actually, I got stung myself. I was a victim of a minor fraud, obviously to do with Canada, but a fake Canadian visa application website. And you chalk that sort of thing up to experience. What you have to do is to avoid the frauds that can seriously destroy your ability to continue having the kind of economic life that you wanted to have. It's the big frauds that make the difference. And so what I suggest in the book is that if you're concentrating on the big frauds that can really impair the economies that they are parasitic on, the characteristic of them is that they grow. Anything demonstrating rapid exponential growth is either a fantastic success story like an iPhone, or it's a fraud. And the way that you check whether it's a fraud or not is to check something out in a way that it has not been checked out before. Because a really big, structural, massive fraud will have been designed around all of the existing control systems that the fraudster could think of when he was deciding how to do his fraud. I think that is the way of catching the really big stuff that can destroy you. The little stuff that is just irritating, you can be aware, you can be on your toes, but really, sooner or later, one of them is going to end up catching you.
The big ones, checking it out in a way it hasn't been checked out before. I would think, though, that most of us don't have the skills or knowledge to do that.
It depends, because a lot of the time, it's just a matter of checking whether things are literally physically possible, checking whether a factory actually exists or not. So I'm not necessarily sure it's about specialist knowledge. In many of these frauds, I ended up thinking that the more specialist knowledge you had, the more committed you were likely to be to the blind spots that the fraudster was working around. So I think actually your listeners are just as likely or unlikely to catch these things as me or any of the people I've worked with.
Dan, it's a fascinating book and it's been really interesting talking to you. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Dan Davis is the author of Lying for Money, How Legendary Frauds Reveal the Workings of Our World. You'll find details on our homepage at abc.net.au/Radio National. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Adie.